It's really an honor for us to have Rav Stav, who is one of the foremost leaders and thinkers in the modern Orthodox religious Zionist world, and it's really a kavod for us. We've had him here in the past. He's the founder of Tzohar, and I don't know if, you know, fortunately or unfortunately, they have a lot of work that has to be done in Israel to build bridges, to bring light. Tzohar, that's the origin, of course, from Noach. I assume that's the origin of the name. By Noach, it's Tzohar Tasa to the Teva. You have to bring light. And that's, I think, his life epitomizes this the bridging together and the working together for the many, many segments of Klal Yisrael. And of course, he's the Rav of the city of Shoham, which I have not been there yet, but it's a model city of a religious and secular, quote-unquote, whatever those terms mean exactly, community. And without further ado, we're honored to have you. Rav Stav will be speaking at Or Chaim on Shabbat morning for those who live in the area, and he's a hearty soul. He'll be speaking at the Beit before Mincha for those who live in the 905 area. So we'll get a little bit of exercise on Shabbat. Vakasha, Rav Stav.
Good evening to everybody. Thank you for the very warm words. Welcome on. We are now in the days of Sfirat HaOmer that I think in modern history changed or gave us a different taste of the meaning of the preparation of that period of time in the year between Pesach and Shavuot, where in modern history there were added two dates to this period of time. The date of the Independence Day that happened to fall on Hei Be'iyar. You know, there is one of the Mefarshim of Shulchan Aruch that points out the following statement. It's written that 30 days before a holiday, 30 days before Pesach, you should start to prepare yourself to that holiday. And therefore, you have to learn the halachot of Pesach 30 days before Pesach, which comes to be Purim. And 30 days before Sukkot, you have to start preparing yourself to Sukkot, which is in the middle of Elul. And 30 days before Shavuot, you have to prepare yourself to Shavuot. And what's the date that is 30 days before Shavuot? Since Iyar is not a full month, so the Ba'er Hetev says, Hey Be'iyar, it's the time that you have to prepare yourself to Shavuot. That's the Independence Day. And a few weeks later, we added to the Jewish calendar another date, which is Yom Yerushalayim, that falls a week before Shavuot, which gives another taste, another meaning for that preparation. We started that period of time with describing, with celebrating the memorial of the physical miracle of getting out of Egypt, and preparing ourselves to the next step, to the next level of Shavuot, which deals with the spiritual level, with the spiritual meaning of being a part of the Jewish people, and that's Shavuot. And the holiday that relates to that is Yom Yerushalayim, that gave the Jewish state, the Israeli state, a spiritual meaning of what does it mean to be a Jewish state in the land of Israel, which actually relates to Yerushalayim, to the place of the Beit HaMikdash, etc., etc. There is a very unique statement that is written in Sefer Melachim. Elisha, the prophet, comes after Eliyahu passes away. He goes b'se'ara, with a storm, to heaven. And then he walks back from the Jordan River to Jericho. So he comes to the inhabitants of Jericho and asks them, How is Jericho? What's going on there? And he gets the following answer. Moshav Ha'ir Tov. It's a beautiful city. It's a wonderful city. Hamayim Ra'im. The water are bad. V'ha'aretz Meshakelet. Meshakelet means the land kills its citizens. Many people die here. So then I guess we all ask ourselves, so if it is so bad, how is it so good? And if it is so good, what else does a man need when he comes to live in a city, if not to have water and to have lives? And yet, they are telling him, Moshav Ha'ir Tov. It's a wonderful place to live. But we could not close our eyes and ignore the problems that we have here. And we have a lot of problems. But never forget that despite all the problems, still, Moshav Ha'ir Tov. It's a wonderful place to live in. And I think that when we come to discuss the topic that I was asked to talk about this evening, the struggle for Jewish state, for Jewish identity in Israel, for Jewish identity to the Israelis, we have to begin with, first of all, with saying Moshav Ha'ir Tov. I guess all of our parents, all of our great parents, especially when you celebrate Yom HaAtzmaut a week after the Memorial Day for the Holocaust, all our great-grandparents would have loved to think that their grandchildren have to confront with the problems that we have to confront with, instead of dealing with the problems that they had to deal with. So, Moshav Ha'ir Ahu Tov. We, Baruch Hashem, we have a wonderful state and a wonderful country, and we have such a privilege, and we actually ask ourselves, at least I ask myself almost every day, why do we deserve to have that privilege to live in such a beautiful place, in such a meaningful place? And it doesn't cover, and we don't want to hide the problems, and I will refer to them in a few moments. And every year, when I come and I take my kids on the day of Kafchet Be'iyar, the day of Yom Shichur Yerushalayim, and I take them to the Wailing Wall, and I'm taking them to Machane Yehuda, to the market, to taste the fruit, to walk in the streets, and I read every year the words that the Ramban wrote to his family, describing his visit 800 years ago in ancient Jerusalem. And it describes the following. He goes, he's walking in the old part of Jerusalem, because there wasn't another part of Jerusalem. And he meets, a few hundred meters before the Wailing Wall, he meets two painters. And he asks them whether it's possible to have a minyan. He wants to daven mincha or mariv or whatever he wants to daven. And the two Jewish painters thinks he's kidding them. And they say to him, are you serious? Do you think you'll find 10 Jewish people near the Wailing Wall to daven mincha or to daven something? Didn't you hear the rule that the holier the place is, the more destructive he is? Kol ha-kadosh mi-chavero, charev mi-chavero. There is no way to find a minion in the Wailing Wall. And when you come today to Yerushalayim, and when you come today to the Wailing Wall, and you see so many minyanim, the only question is whether it's mincha or mariv, whether it's a late shachris or an early mincha. But there is 24 hours, 7 days a week, minyanim. Next week, I think, or in 2 weeks, the Pope is coming to visit Yerushalayim, the Wailing Wall. He was supposed to arrive at 7 o'clock or at 7:30 to the Kotel. So the people that daven Vatikin there complained to the Minister of Internal Security that the visit at 7 o'clock in the morning is going to disturb to the Vatikin minyan. So His Almighty had to postpone his visit in an hour. So he will come at 9 o'clock, not to disturb the Jews that want to daven Shachris. And all the people, the secular people that want to celebrate the Bar Mitzvahs early in the morning. Could we imagine 50 years ago, 100 years ago, Jewish people say to the Pope, the head of the Christians all over the world, please wait an hour, come to us later, because we have to finish Shachris. So when we speak about the empty part of the cup, and we'll speak about that, we have yet to remember how glad we are and how privileged we are to live in that state and to live in that generation. When I hear from time to time people that compare the current situation in the state of Israel, despite all the problems, that compare them to the gzerot of Haman or Antiochus or whatever brutal ruler or king that ruled ever in the land of Israel, I think, what kind of kfiyut tova is that? I mean, if Jews would ever dreamt to have the privilege to live in such a time, and to compare this time living under the Jewish government, to compare that to the non-Jewish anti-Semitic rulers that governed the land of Israel and tried to make all Jews to disappear from that world, to compare, to dare to compare, what kind of a comparison is that? But yet, after saying all that, we have to admit that the tension that exists in Israel between societies, and the tension that causes a lot of Jews, a lot of Israelis, to feel a gap that has been created and is becoming bigger and bigger between them and what Judaism represents. And the fact that more and more Jews feel that they do not want to be connected to what Jewish tradition is representing, this is something that we should be concerned about. Let me just give you an example. And maybe it's an example that for Americans, for Canadians that come to visit Israel, it could look very unique. I guess that when we come, when we land in Israel, and we'll come at that time of the year, the days before Shavuot, between Pesach and Shavuot, and you will see on the buses or a part of the buses that it's written there, the buses of Eged, Hayom Shloshim Yom Laomer. So I guess an observant, an Orthodox Jew that comes from Toronto and he sees that advertising on the buses of Eged, he says to himself, wow, that's a reason to come, to make Aliyah, to live in a Jewish country, to live in a Jewish state. Where else could you see that statement, Ayom Shloshim Laomer? I'm saying specifically Shloshim, although I know that the number tonight is going to change, because I don't want to go into the halachic question whether I'm allowed to mention the day, because I guess it's already in the time of the Shkia. So, when you see that, I guess everybody will be impressed. And if you want to learn the Israeli crisis of Jewish identity in Israel in these days, take this as an example, and we will learn a short lesson just about that anecdote. From both sides, when Eged started advertising Hayom Kach Rekach LaOmer, two groups struggled against Eged, and that's why they had to remove this advertising. One group was the Haredim that said, it's a disgrace to the Sfiras HaOmer. I mean, it's a zilzul. You put the Omer on the buses. It's a part of shul. That's one edge of society. The second edge, the secular and the anti-religious group said, what is that, a religious coercion? We don't want to hear about Sefirat HaOmer. You put it on the buses? I mean, leave it to the shuls. So both groups said, leave it to the shuls. Don't put it on the buses. One group doesn't want to hear from Sefirat HaOmer because it reminds them something too Jewish. And the second group does not want to hear from Sefirat HaOmer and the buses because it relates to them in shul and it doesn't relate to the buses. We all heard recently about the problems that the circumcision, that Brit Milah has in Germany, in Denmark, in Sweden, in other places. We in Tzohar held a convention 2 days ago with more than 100 Moalim describing the problems and the articles that are written in Israel, in the Jewish state, against Brit Milah. There are attempts to persuade, to convince more and more people not to have Brit Milah in the state of Israel. And you ask ourselves, how come a mitzvah that usually throughout thousands of years, 95-98% of the Jews, despite the fact that they were not observant, were so makpid to have Brit Milah for the kids, to observe that element that keeps us kind of something that we share all in common, despite all the differences between Jews, but yet that mitzvah was usually observed. And here in the state of Israel, more and more people, Baruch Hashem, it's yet a minority, but it's a noisy minority that nobody says, well, it's not legitimate even to say that. No, it's a voice that it's well heard. They come to sessions in the Knesset, different kinds of groups. How come? How come did we arrive to a point that such a big hatred exists between Jews and religion, between Jews and their tradition? Recently, I think the Knesset, during the winter time, winter season, had to deal with almost 30 proposals that were attempt to establish different kind of bills in the Knesset. All of them dealt with the relationship between state and religion. For almost 66 years of the existence of the state of Israel, there was not one season in the Knesset that there were so many bills that dealt with that issue. Usually, most of the bills in the Knesset deal with economy, welfare, social issues, almost nothing about state and religion. Now, in the summer season of the Knesset, we are going to deal, till now, updated to today, 23 bills that are going to be discussed in the Knesset. I don't know how many will pass, but a part of them is going to pass. And what are going to be the outcomes of that? How did we arrive to that? Well, first of all, again, I will start with the good part of that. Baruch Hashem, Israel is in a very good situation economically, and even despite all the criticism socially. And even if we talk about security, relatively, the last couple of years were the best years for the state of Israel since it was established 66 years ago. We know, we are all aware of the Iranian threat, but to be honest with you, to talk frankly here, I don't think that there are many Israelis that, maybe they are wrong, but I don't think there are many Israelis that are really concerned about these issues. Most of them don't talk about that, not on Friday night, family meals, not in other events. That's not an issue. most of them deal, talk, discuss in their living rooms discussions. They discuss about economy, but the second topic that they discuss is state and religion. And why? Is number one because, Baruch Hashem, we are in such a good situation physically that we could allow ourselves to deal with other issues. With actually with the spiritual issues that these are the reasons why we arrive to the state of Israel. Why we arrive to the land of Israel. So Baruch Hashem, it's time to discuss these issues. And more Israelis want to understand what are they doing there. And what will be the essence of their lives in the Jewish state of Israel. So more and more Israelis are interested to discuss these issues and to raise things that disturb them, that they are concerned about. So therefore, that's the positive part about it. What is this? What is the negative part about that? People feel that they have nothing in common with what religion, what the Jewish religion represents. And that's something that should concern us. It's not only that they don't feel that the religion represents something that they feel could feel affiliated with, but they feel even the negative. They feel that they don't want to be a part of that. That what Jewish tradition represents is something that causing them to keep a distance from that. And I could use hundreds of examples just to understand what we are talking about. If you, and I don't want to go into the details, but if you see this week, just this week, a story of a performer, a Russian immigrant that arrived to the state of Israel after suffering lots of years in Russia, and she arrives to Israel, and it takes her months and months to prove that she's Jewish. Just because she wanted to get married halachically, and she could not get assistance from the rabbinate or from the government. And she is a part of a group that is more than 700,000 immigrants that could not, or they find it very difficult to prove that they are Jewish. And the official law that exists in Israel does not allow them to get married if they do not prove that they are halachically Jewish. So the secular Israeli that hears that, and these were the reactions in the media. How come people that came from places far away from us and they want to be a part of that of us and they are Jewish? And they maintain that they are Jewish. They find it so difficult to prove that they are Jewish. Who needs it? You, the rabbis, are responsible for all these people that want to be Jewish and you push them away. So if the average Israeli doesn't want to go into all the details, because, you know, we are in a time that we don't have too much time to read all the articles in the small letters. We read only the headlines. So he hears only the following. The rabbis caused a problem. These immigrants could hardly prove that they are Jewish. That's enough. That's enough for him. And then he reads another article. I'm just summarizing the headlines of the website, of the Israeli website from this week. And then he reads another article of a rabbi that published in his neighborhood that a teacher of dances, she was lesbian. And therefore, this rabbi published in all the neighborhoods around that they would not take lessons by her because she's that. She's that and that. And he advertised that. So what do you think people will think about that? Are these rabbis crazy? I mean, what are they dealing with? And now I'm not going into the halachic issues, whether it's permitted or it's not permitted to learn by that teacher. I'm not going into that. And then a day later, another rabbi writes a psak that You are not allowed to rent your apartment to a lesbian. And then the Minister of Justice, Tzipi Livni, says she's going to sue him for discriminating these groups, etc., etc. I mean, what do you think that the secular people will think about us? So, that half part that causes a lot of people to feel that they don't want to be affiliated with Judaism and with our tradition, I mean, we deserve it. I mean, we bought it with a lot of effort and we succeeded. They hate us. I mean, and they know why. And I guess you all know, Shabbos night is like Bomer. And all the secular people know that like Bomer, it's a whole festival in Meron. And they always hear, just 2 weeks ago, there was an Independence Day, and the Memorial Day for Chayalei Tzal, for the soldiers, was on Motzei Shabbat. And the chief rabbin had decided that because there is a risk, or there is a chance that there will be Chilul Shabbos, preparing in the preparations to the Memorial Day, so they decided to postpone the Memorial Day and the Independence Day from Sunday to Monday, and the Independence Day from Monday to Tuesday. And I think they were right. But when it comes to Lag BaOmer, and everybody knows that the Chilul Shabbos that's going to take place during that Shabbos, because of thousands of policemen and firemen and inspectors and other people that will have no other choice but to Mechalel Shabbat during the Shabbos in order to help the religious groups to arrive to Lag BaOmer to light the fire, which is not written in Shulchan Aruch, it's not written in Rambam, it's not in Halacha, it's just a habit. But nobody is ready to think it over, to rethink. Maybe we should postpone the lighting of the fire a day later. Would Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai be happier if he knows that thousands of policemen will not have to be Mechalel Shabbos in order to light the fire on Saturday night? Wouldn't you be happier? But what does the secular group learn from that? That actually, Shabbos is all politics. It's all about politics. It's not about Judaism. Because when it comes to their interests, they don't care about the Shabbos. They don't care what happens to us in Shabbos. When it comes to Yom HaAtzmaut, everybody's concerned that we will not be Mechalel Shabbos. But when it comes to their issues, so then Shabbos is no more holy. And these are just examples from the public sessions that took place during the last 5 days, 6 days. And I could add to that, every week there is another issue that is discussed. So when people feel that religion is connected directly to politics and to power and to coercion, people want to keep a distance from that. And this causes hatred, and this causes ignorance. Because once you say to yourself, I don't want to learn, I don't want to be affiliated with that, it's very hard to differentiate between learning Tanakh, you will learn, and being affiliated with Judaism, you don't want to be affiliated. To know the differences, it's very difficult. It's very hard to create a kind of dichotomy that will say that I want to be Jewish, but I want to be Jewish in my way. Maybe we would prefer them to behave in such a way, but most of the people could not live in such a complexity. And they have to choose whether we want to be more Jewish or to be more Israeli, they will take a decision, and the decision, as Jews know how to take decisions, there will be very tough and hard decisions. What should we do and what could be done in order to struggle for Jewish identity for the Israelis, for the state of Israel? I know one word that we have to fight with and one word that we have to struggle for, that we have to stand for. We have to fight against coercion. We have to struggle for competition, for privatization of the system. Everything that has a monopoly, every institute that has a monopoly, monopoly leads to corruption. Monopoly leads to political intervention. Monopoly leads to coercion, and monopoly leads to the place where we are now. Because nobody in the monopoly feels that he is threatened, because nobody threatens him, and therefore he has no reason to improve. And again, I want to go back to the example of Brit Mila. 3 years ago, I'm referring now to a very small project of Tzohar. I'm not talking yet about the weddings, not about roots, about helping the Russians. I'm talking about a very small problem, very small project. 2.5 years ago, Tzohar announced that we have a problem with the circumcisions, with the Britot Mila. The chief rabbinate said there is no problem. There is no problem. Everybody is having Brit Mila. No problem. So then we started to bring the numbers that in the area of Tel Aviv, 20% of the people are not going to Mohalim, they're going to secular doctors. That usually it means that the Brit is not a halachic Brit. So they denied. No, it's not true. Yesterday, 2 days ago, they admitted that the numbers are not 20%. The numbers are 40%. That's a monopoly. A monopoly that doesn't feel that someone is competing with them, they have no reason to improve. They have no reason to think of ways of changing our image, of trying to understand that you have to convince Jews to have Brit Mila. If you want to convince them, they will not do that. Once you are a monopoly and nobody threatens you, you don't see any reason to improve yourself. As a matter of fact, more than 100 Mo'alim were there, 80% of them were Haredim, and they all said after that evening that since they became Mo'alim 10, 20, 30 years ago, they've never had one evening teaching them how to present the ideas of Brit Mila to secular society. It's the first training that they had since they became Mo'alim, not on how to make the Brit, but how to present Judaism, how to talk to the couples, to feel their concern, to understand that they are afraid, they don't take it for granted. These times that everybody was sure that he's going to have a Brit, these times are gone. But don't be desperate. We are not. We believe that we can change it. But it depends on our behavior. It depends in the way we will present it. And the same thing applies to weddings. We have in these days, we have to push away every year more than 1,000 couples that want to get married through Tzohar. We have more than 5,000 couples that are registered through Tzohar. 10 years ago, we had less than 2,000. Now we have more than 5. And if we had the resources, we could have expanded more and more. When I say to my people, to my rabbis, I want the numbers to grow, they say, no, we cannot do that because we don't have the resources to do that. So we have to push. If a couple comes now to Tzohar and he wants to register, they tell him, well, if you plan to get married before September, don't come to us because we have no room. So if you want to postpone your wedding to October, November, so then come over to us. We have no room for you now. I mean, there are ways to convince people to come. But you have to understand that you live in a world of freedom of choice, of freedom of belief, of freedom of religion. And you have to compete. And you have to improve yourself. And you have to convince. You know, there were years, and yet, even now, the chief rabbinate, although there is already a bill in the Knesset that was already established a few months ago, which is called Tzohar Bill, that allows to open the zones of marriages in order to encourage competition between the rabbinates to improve the services, yet the chief rabbinate does not recognize in that law. The history of that law is very short, it's very simple. In the state of Israel, every couple had to get registered in his town, where the state was divided to zones of marriage, and each local rabbi was responsible for his town. Which sounds logically, but there is only one problem. 50% of the rabbis don't recognize the conversions that the chief rabbinate has done itself. So one hand, the right hand of the rabbinate, does not recognize what the left hand of the rabbinate has done. So take, for instance, a couple that lives in Ashdod. And the chief rabbinate of Ashdod does not, these two Russians, one of them is a convert. The rabbinate, the local rabbinate of Ashdod, does not recognize his conversion or her conversion. So, until last year, this couple could not get married in Israel because the local rabbi does not allow him to get married. He doesn't recognize his conversion. So, he cannot get registered in a second city because it's not permitted. So, what choice does he have? After saying that he hates the rabbinate and hates everything that relates to religion because of all the troubles they've caused him. So what can he do? He had no other choice but to fly to Cyprus or to apply to the Supreme Court or to go to Tzohar. So we changed the law. And the law says now that everybody could get registered wherever he wants to. And yet the rabbinate doesn't understand that instead of cooperating with that, instead of coordinating with this, they try to struggle against that because they are afraid of that competition. And now what is the positive part of that? 2 days ago, I see two local rabbinates, the rabbinate of Tel Aviv and the rabbinate of Ramat Gan, advertising in the website. You don't have to come to our office. You could get registered through the website. And by us, it's cheaper than it's by Tzohar. Wonderful. Go ahead, continue. That's how it should look like. You want to improve your services? Please do it. That's how it should look. We know that we might suffer from that, and maybe it will cause us to improve ourselves. And I'm sure we have also things that we have to improve ourselves. But that's how it should look like. That people will feel that they are customers, that we don't take them for granted. So we will have to improve our services in bride counseling, in groom counseling, in the registration, in the rabbis. And we'll have to train the rabbis more and more to be more attractive. That's how it should look. The same thing applies to all other areas of the relationship between state and religion. Take the example of kashrut, for instance. I'm not talking about corruption, although it exists, but that's not the main thing. Could you imagine that what is considered in the States, in the United States of America, as one of the most important kashrut supervisors, OU, is not allowed to be imported to the state of Israel if it's consisted of milk? Could you imagine that OUD is not allowed to be imported to the state of Israel? And if a restaurant would serve the Philadelphia cheese, they will not have kashrut. That's the truth. And if they will try to give the Agendas ice cream, they will lose their kashrut supervision. Why? Because the chief rabbi does not allow halav akum to be in the state of Israel. Now, It's not that I think it's that you should not drink Chalav Israel if it's possible. I really believe that this should be done, especially in Israel, where there is no problem of Chalav Israel. But give the people the choice. You could have, you want to be more makpid, you want to have a mehadrin, have a mehadrin. Now, if all the Israelis would have accepted these rules and would have kept kosher because of that, Baruch Hashem, wonderful. But I'm telling you that there are hundreds of restaurants that feed the people non-kosher food because they don't have the ability to serve OUD, products that are under OUD. Now please, give the people the choice. If someone, it's good enough for him to eat OUD, allow him that. Why do you behave like a monopoly? It's not that you behave like a monopoly. You are a monopoly. And once you are a monopoly and you draw the rules, actually you cause a lot of people not to eat kosher. I remember once I met someone in America and he told me the following story. He had a restaurant somewhere in one of the hotels and he asked the rabbi to give him kashrut. And the rabbi came over to the hotel and he saw the restaurant and he said, I can't give kashrut. So I asked him, why? So he said, because of the mixed swimming pool. So I said to him, if you told me that you saw flesh and milk mixed, I understand. But why are you bothered because of the people? I mean, you're giving hechsher to the restaurant, not to the people, not to the swimming pool. Now, afterward, it did not convince him. And he told me that person that the restaurant continue, but it feeds its people nevelot, utrefot. And now everybody is satisfied. The restaurant doesn't have kashrut. The swimming pool is continuing to be a mixed swimming pool. But hundreds of Jews eat nevelot and trefot. So that's what we gained out of that. Now, if people want to behave this way, it's okay. Give them the freedom of choice. Create a competition. Create something that will give the people a diverse possibilities in order to allow each one of them to choose what fits to him. And don't force them to do things that they don't want to. I could give a few other examples, but I think that's enough in order to understand that the struggle for influencing Jewish identity on the Israeli society is not gone yet. We are in the middle of that. And the entire wave of bills that deal with these issues show at least one good sign, that the Israelis care about their identity. They care about their Jewish identity. They want to feel Jewish. They want to feel Jewish in their way. They don't want to feel coerced. They don't want to feel that they give up to a monopoly that they don't feel a part of. But they really want to be Jewish. And that's our challenge, to make the religion and to make tradition accessible to them. It's our challenge to do all efforts in order to bridge gaps that exist and gaps that they want to fill, that they want them to be bridged. But it all depends in our understanding, in our pushing the society and the leaders and the politicians and the rabbis to understand that we could not live in a democratic, liberal society with coercion. If we want to win that battle and that campaign, and we could, because there is such a deep thirst for more spirituality and for more connections to Judaism, but if we want to succeed, we have to work hard for that. And we cannot take anything for granted, and we cannot force people to do what we want. We will have to struggle on the hearts and the minds of each one of them in order to convince them that we are, that we have something important, something meaningful to offer to them. I guess that I spoke a lot, and I guess I have a lot more to speak, but I guess there are several questions, and if not, I will continue. If yes, I will answer.
Oh, no, there's someone.
The new chief rabbi in Israel, Rav Lau, doesn't he make any change?
I think it's not a problem of people. Rabbi Lau is a very good man. And that's not, the issue is not about his attempts to do good or to do bad. He's trying to do a lot of good things. He is not the problem. The system is the problem. And if he tries to make changes, and he tries to make changes, for instance, in the import department of kosher products, and when he asked his officers, what are the criterions of which kashrut do you allow to bring in, and which kashrut you don't allow to bring in, and there were a lot of screams, and they never gave him an answer. What are the criterions? But he could not change it, because he's not a part of the people that understand that in order to change that, you have to change it from its root. And the root is not in the rabbinate. It's not among the bureaucracy of the officers. The root is in the Knesset. You could change it in one moment if you establish a law that there will be a freedom of input of kosher products, and that there will not be an officer that will say, well, this kashrut I accept and this kashrut I do not accept, I reject. And once you will start looking after the products or after the supervisions that he accepts and that he rejects, you'll be surprised to be what are the criterions. First of all, there are no criterions. I guess that many of the criterions are the different kinds of relationship between the importers and the rabbis. I think that it's a very important question. I think that the answer, the world is not divided to Haredim and non-Haredim. And it's not that the Zionists are open-minded and the Haredim are not open-minded. It's not true. There are Haredi leaders that are very, very much open-minded, and there are Zionist religious leaders that are very narrow-minded. The world is not divided. There are divisions of Haredim and Al-Haredim, but the open mind does not belong to one group, and the narrow mind does not belong to another group, not at all. But I think that the political leadership of the Haredi parties are yet suffering from the lack of understanding that power, their power, and their attempt to utilize the power in order to control all the religious aspects of the state of Israel cause a tremendous damage to religion in the state of Israel. They start to understand that, not enough, too late and too little. But it doesn't, again, I'm speaking now about the political leadership, the Haredi rabbis, there are many of them that understand that. I mean, if you follow them, there is, for instance, a rabbi, his name is Rabbi David Bloch. A very unique rabbi, and he writes every week an article in Haredi websites. And he keeps on attacking the Haredi political leadership for not understanding what's going on in the society, for not explaining itself, for not confronting with the needs of the secular society, for being arrogant, for being ignorant,
from their side, etc., etc. So I think there are voices that understand the need, the urgent need to open the system, to privatize the system. Not enough. I guess there might be, maybe I guess more than one element of corruption, but I don't want to focus on that. I mean, it's true, because everywhere when there is a monopoly, there is a corruption, and this is not something that we could have the rights of creating that in the state of Israel. I mean, we have just heard in the last couple of days a kind of few, I think, religious or rabbis that stole couple of million dollars from the money that was supposed to arrive to schools for special needs. Or so it's not something that we take responsibility in the state of Israel for creating all these corruptions. That's not the main thing. I mean, it could be involved with corruption, but the problem is not the corruption. The corruption is symptomatic to that, but the essence of the problem is the monopoly. The essence of the problem is that you don't respect the fact that the society is divided to several levels and that there are people that want to eat basic kashrut and they don't want to be mehadar, and there are others that want to be mehadar, and please respect all of them. Give the people that want to have basic kashrut, allow them to have basic kashrut. If I don't want to eat there, I won't eat there. And give others, that treat others with dignity and respect and allow them to have mehadrin. And if you want to have mehadrin, create another level of kashrut. It's not that I want to be makel or to be machmer. I want the rabbis and I want the leaders to treat all Jews with such respect and dignity that will give them the feeling that I care about them, that I don't want to force them, I don't want to coerce them, and actually I want to persuade them to become closer to me. I want to access Judaism to them, and I don't want to force it on them. And Kashrut was just an example for the way to do it instead of creating a monopoly, to privatize the system, the way of supervising the kashrut. The same thing applies to weddings, and that's what I mentioned, the opening the zones of marriages. The same thing applies, I believe, that courts for divorce should be the same, should work the same way. I mean, we know for sure already now that a couple, that there are rabbinic courts that are terrible for the woman, and there are rabbinic courts that are terrible for both sides, because it takes them a very long time until they finish their story. So why don't you let the couple to choose the Beis Din that they want to go to? What damage? So I just heard a few days ago from the deputy of religious affairs, from the deputy of the Minister of Religious Affairs, saying the following. He went to the chief rabbi, to the Sephardic chief rabbi that is in charge on the rabbinical courts. Now, in one of the proposals that we try to advance now, to promote now, is the conversion bill that will allow every convert, every candidate for conversion, to go to which rabbi that he wants to which local rabbi that he wants to. And Rav Yosef said to Rav Ben-Dahan, it's impossible. If I live in Kiryat Shmona, I will be able to come to the Rav of Shoham to convert? It's impossible. We never heard about such a thing. So Rav Ben-Dahan says to him, why not? Did you ever know that if a couple wants to pick up a Beis Din for divorce, and they live in a different state, in different city, they change their address in the identity card, it takes 5 minutes, and they pretend like they live in another city, because they heard that in that city it's easier to get divorced. So why to do it in such a indirect and way? Why don't you let it loudly, publicly? Give everybody the freedom to choose where what Beidin he wants to go to, which rabbi he wants to, he feels connected to. Why not? Why do you have to be so strict? I said, oh, I didn't realize that people are changing their addresses and that it's very easy to change address in the state of Israel. You don't have to prove nothing. You don't have to show that you have a contract of renting an apartment. You don't have to do nothing. You just have to say to the officer, my address from now on is that, that and that. And that's it. And after you finish the divorce, you change your address back. If you want to, if you don't want, you leave it this way. I mean, nobody cares. So why do we have to create, you know, the first lesson, I always tell that the people that I speak when I describe how it looked like to go to the rabbinate in previous times. Baruch Hashem, I think we have changed it recently with the new chief rabbis. I'll give you that example. It's a very cynical and kind of a sad example, but it's a very cute one. In Israel, until the last year, when a couple wanted to get married, it could not get registered prior to 3 months before the wedding. Usually, when a couple wants to get married, they have to order the hall at least 8, 9, 10 months before the wedding. Okay, so they arrive to the rabbinate 3 months. For instance, the wedding is in August 15th, so they arrive to the rabbinate May 15th. Not earlier, because earlier nobody would have accepted them. So they arrive to the rabbinate on May 15th, and the second question was, the rabbi asks the girl, does the date of the wedding fit to your biological cycle? What are you talking about? I mean, she lives already with her boyfriend for almost 5 years, and you are talking to her about the biological cycle. She never shares it with foreign men. I mean, her biological cycle. What do you mean, does it mean? And suppose she wants to fit it to her biological cycle. Could she do it now? You didn't allow her to register 8 months before the wedding. So actually, the first lesson that the secular couple learns when they put their foot in the stairs of the rabbinate, the first lesson is how to cheat the rabbi. Because that girl has to go to her religious observant girlfriend to ask her, what should I answer to the rabbi when he will ask me that question? So the observant girlfriend will tell her, you have to say that the date is this and this and that, and that's how they will figure it out, and then you'll be okay. That's the first lesson. Now, we came over to the chief rabbis for almost 15 years ago, telling them it's impossible. You forced them to lie. Now, it's all built on trust. I mean, if she doesn't want to prepare herself in the proper way, in the halachic proper way to the wedding, she will not do that. She could cheat you. Even if she'll go to the mikveh before the wedding, she could nobody will be able to check her what date she went to the mikveh. But if you really want to convince her to go to at least once to have the tefillah done as it should be done, so at least give her the opportunity to do that. So please open the opportunity to be registered a year before the wedding. 15 years we have been struggling for that. To change that stupid decision that a couple could not open the file, could not be registered prior to 3 months before the wedding. And the official answer that we got a year and a half ago, why can't we open that? There were a few officers that said, look, there are couples that after they registered, they cancel their plan to get married. So what's the problem? So So if they cancel the program to get married, so then we will have to give them back the money. So we will have to work twice. We charge the money, and then we have to give them back the money. So I asked the chief rabbi, are you serious? Is that the reason? How many couples cancel their weddings? It seems like it's a wave of couples that everybody is getting registered, and right after he gets registered, he cancels his wedding. You talk about 1%, 0.5%. So that's the reason why you cause so many troubles for so many couples? So Baruch Hashem, we spoke to the Sephardic chief rabbi a few months ago, and we convinced him that it's stupid, that rule, and he was convinced, and thank God, a few months ago, this decision was changed. So, it's not that we don't move. We move forward, slowly, but one step in a moment, and you know, I heard once from Rav Aviner a very cute story. You know that Yeshivat HaTorat Kohanim is helping to buy houses from the Arabs in the ancient part of Jerusalem. So he described with such a joyous and happiness the buying the apartments from the Arabs. So it was when I was Rosh Yeshiva in Antwerp. So one of the students asked him, raised his finger and said, Kvod HaRav, suppose you'll succeed. When do you think you'll be able to say that all the Arab houses in Jerusalem are now by Jewish hands? So he said, you know, very seriously, I think if we'll move fast, in 300 years, it will be done. So I learned a lot from that answer, that 300 years is considered to be quick. So we have patience, but to be honest, we don't have that much of patience. And we try to move things faster and quicker. And Baruch Hashem, we feel that we move faster. The fact that we have today 5,000 weddings a year, that's a move. The fact that rabbinets try to compete with us, that's moving forward. The fact that the conversion issues are now raised to the high priority of the Knesset, that's moving. The fact that we deal with the issues of state and religion, and everybody understands, or almost everybody understands, that we have to improve our approach, to change our approach to secular society. That's moving forward. So, Baruch Hashem, we feel that we have done a lot. There is yet a lot more to be done, but Baruch Hashem. Rav Kamel,
a very complicated question. I will say the following. Look, I personally in Shoham, and I believe that in the entire state of Israel, we should allow conservative and reform communities to exist, and we should allow everybody to struggle on the hearts of the Israelis. A part of freedom of choice is to allow people to choose in ways that I don't believe in. But we cannot coerce people to do things that they don't want to. I believe that that's, by the way, the only way to improve orthodoxy. Because the orthodoxy doesn't see any reason to improve itself. And when I say to improve, it's not to change halachic issues, chas v'chalila, but to improve its approach. And I will give an example in a minute. Unless we will feel that there is a threat. So if the question is about allowing them to open synagogues and communities, I'm definitely supportive of that. If you refer to conversions or to marriages, I'm against that. And the reason is very simple. Because of the reason that I don't agree to allow civil marriage in Israel,
And there's only one reason for that. Because I want to keep the infrastructure of the Jewish people as one united team, as a one united unit. And I understand that once there will be civil marriage, the meaning of that, the outcome of that, will be an increasing and dramatic number of intermarriage. And since I believe that Israel is the last place and the only place in the world that will guarantee the Jewish continuity, when we see the numbers of the Pew researchers of the intermarriage in the States, and we see what civil marriage caused in the States, we understand that the only way to guarantee Jewish continuity of the Jewish people in the state of Israel is by not allowing civil marriage and by not allowing reform and conservative marriages, because these marriages will be consisted also from couples that are not necessarily halachically Jewish. So therefore, there is no other way but to put the fence here and to say, ad kan, until here. And otherwise, the results will be that the next generation in the state of Israel will have 30 or 40 or 50% of intermarriage. Why? Because already today, as I described before, the problems of Russians to prove their Jewish identity. These 700,000 people that are getting married to 700,000 Israelis, if they will find it easier to get married in a reform wedding or a conservative or in a civil marriage where nobody will ask for their Jewish roots, so then we will never have the chance to prove that they are halachically Jews. So actually we give up. We push them out of the Jewish people. And I don't want this to happen. I want all these 700,000 people to be with us. They did not escape from Russia to become non-Jewish people here in the state of Israel. So I feel it's my responsibility to make sure that they will, so that they will be Jewish. They will be Jews. So on one hand, I fight against the rabbinate. Please do all efforts and make all efforts. And that's what we are doing here in Tzohar. By the way, with the assistance of one of the people here, with Dov Friedberg, that helps us a lot to prove the Jewish identity of these people. With others, that philanthropists from Australia and other places, all over the world, in order to help these people to prove that they are Jewish. So on one hand, we accuse and we criticize the government and the rabbinate for not helping us enough. On the other hand, we don't want to lose them. We don't want to miss them. We want them to remain Jewish. And that's why when I talked to Yair Lapid, and when I met with Tzipi Livni, and she asked me, why don't you agree to our initiatives to have the couplehood alliance or civil marriage or whatever name you name it? I tell them, look, you want me to help these people to prove that they are halachically Jewish? You want me to help them? You want me to help these people that want to convert? You want me to help them to convert? You can't tell me that I should convert them. I should help them to prove that they are halachically Jewish. And to put a knife in my back by saying, you don't have to prove nothing, because you can get married wherever you want, however you want. So that's the only thing that I believe that we should not give to the reform and the conservative. Because once we give it, actually we give up the vision of a Jewish identity, a common Jewish identity for the Jews in the state of Israel. No, I will explain you the difference.
At what point do you draw the line?
I will tell you exactly. I grew up in a yeshivat Merkaz Rav, where Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook said, I am against religious coercion. There is only one thing I don't want to give up, and that's the frame that we belong to. The fact that we all belong to the Jewish people. The only thing I want to guard and to observe and to preserve is the Jewish infrastructure that will guarantee continuity for the next generation. That's the only thing I want to do. I don't want to curse nobody to be observant. I don't want to curse nobody to eat kosher. I don't want Nobody to force him to do nothing. I want only one thing. I want to have the ability to live together in the next generation with you. I want us to remain one nation. That's the only thing I want to cause. You have to understand, unlike Canada or the United States, I mean, if you have here 60 or 70 or 80% of intermarriage, okay, it has nothing to do with the national security of Canada or the United States. I mean, it has to do with the future of the Jewish community in Canada or in North America in general. But when you deal with Jewish continuity in the state of Israel, that's a national security issue. Because if we will not remain one united nation, despite all the differences and despite all the diversities of people, if we will not feel that we belong to one nation and that we are really a part of one nation, there will be no future for these people, for us. And that's the difference.
Bevakasha.
As you said, it's a very subjective answer. I believe that there are more and more rabbis from all groups, but especially in the group I represent. I mean, I'm the chairman of the Tzohar organization that is consisted of almost 600 rabbis, many of them leading rabbis in the state of Israel. I believe that more and more rabbis from all groups understand that we belong to an era of talking, of discussing, and not forcing, and not coercing. We used to say in Hebrew, we used to say in the past, if it doesn't work with power, use more power. But I think everybody understands now that the right way, the right expression is, nothing is going with power. You cannot force people. You could convince them. You could access them. But you could not force people to do anything. And I think that more and more rabbis from all groups understand that reality of life. And I think that, I mean, each one of them, I guess, takes it to a certain degree. But I believe that more and more rabbis understand that we have to convince people and we cannot force them. I want to give you an example. You mentioned the reform and the conservative movement. I would like to refer to something that actually hurted me a lot. Two or three or four years ago, I don't remember exactly the date, the year, I realized that the Ministry of Education sent all the bar mitzvah kids that suffer from Down syndrome or other syndromes or special needs, sends them to celebrate the bar mitzvah in reforming conservative shuls. And when I asked why, I realized that their response was that Orthodox synagogues don't want to accept them to celebrate bar mitzvah because of various reasons. So I came over to our rabbis, and I said, is it possible? Is that the Orthodox approach to people that suffer so much? So our approach is not to let them to have a bar mitzvah? And we changed it. And we believe that, I guess, the attempt to change it would have been much harder if we did not have a competition, if we wouldn't see that what occurs in the other side's behavior. By the way, it's not hard. It's not easy. It's not easy to convince Orthodox shuls to receive bar mitzvahs, secular bar mitzvahs at all. There are few that complain. The cellular phones are working. You could hear the voices of them ringing during davening, in the middle of Kedusha. And other complain of the modesty of the woman, and other complain about other things. It's not easy to convince shuls to accept secular bar mitzvahs. And when I say to them, so what do you want them to do? You want them to be Jewish? You want them to feel some taste of Judaism? So now we are opening a new project in Tzohar, encouraging shuls to open their doors, but especially their hearts, to receive secular bar mitzvah boys. We cannot complain on the reform and the conservative if the secular families will prefer to go to these communities because we didn't give them a chance to host them by us. So therefore, we believe that we should have a kind of a freedom of choice and to allow people to do that, to choose, to have the right to pick up which community they want to go to. Okay, I think that's the last question. And I think that, by the way, it's a very long answer, but just to say it in short and brief words, I think that even the reform and conservative leaders understand, especially the leaders in the States, understand that we have to create something that will be good for all groups in the state of Israel. And this will mean that you have to obey, to a certain extent, to the Orthodox criterions and not to the reform and conservative. Once you live together, each one of the groups has to give something in order to create a common community, a united community. So I guess that's one of the things that reform and conservative leaders understood already 10, 20 years ago, and I think they understand it now also, that the conversion in Israel will have to be Orthodox in order to make it accessible to everybody and to make it... Look, the Israeli society, you have to understand, everybody understands that the Israeli society is consisted of more than 40% Orthodox Jews. It's not like America that you have less than 10%. In Israel, it's almost 40%. In the Knesset, we have almost 50% of observant Knesset members. So when you deal with this kind of numbers, you can't create conversions that will fit to 2% or 5% of society. Okay, first of all, I want to thank Rav Kelman, and that's the opportunity to thank also to Mr. Bill Nadler that I think runs all the issues of Tzohar during the last 5, 6 or maybe more years, and if someone wants to help us, he's kindly requested to talk to Mr. Nadler, to Beryl, that helps us a lot all these years, and it's an opportunity to say thank you for him also, and thank you again, Rav Kelman.
Thank you very much, really, for the inspiring and moving words. And we look forward to your great work and Hatzlach and the growth of Tzohar and making a real impact. As you say, there are lots of wonderful things in Israel. And with people like you and the supporters, it'll continue to get even more wonderful
Shabbat Shalom to everybody. Good night.